For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Okay, we're here for the workshop on assessing worldview. So if that's what you're into, then you're in the right place. And if you're not into it, you're in the wrong place. But my name is Jim Leffel, and I'm part of the pastoral team here at Xenos. And it's my great pleasure to talk about an area of passion that I've had for a long time, which is the application of logic to systems of belief. And so I want to just pray together and introduce why I think this topic is an important one, and then walk through with you. I've given you the kind of finished version of the PowerPoint slides that we'll be working with, and I'm just going to go through that and talk about what it looks like then to apply basic principles of logic to understanding and assessing the content of a person's belief, and through that, opening doors, hopefully, to communication, finding common ground, finding cracks in the seams that enable us to supply biblical truth in a place where a person's worldview isn't connecting with real need in their life. So why don't we pray together and we'll dive right in. Lord, we thank you so much for this opportunity to be together. Thank you that you've drawn people from Europe and Canada and all over the United States and in many other places as well, just to come together here to seek you out, Lord, asking that you would make us better defenders of our faith in a pluralistic culture, better advocates for the gospel in a world that is lost without you. Help us, Lord, not only to have your mind, but your heart for the people that you've sent us to be living as lights. And so we just pray for a little bit of extra energy here as the post-lunch coma begins to overcome us. Amen. Okay, we're working on two concepts here then this afternoon. The concept of worldview and the concept of assessment. And worldview is just basically the idea that everyone has fundamental beliefs, or what some have called basic beliefs in key areas of life that all human beings, by virtue of their being persons and by virtue of their being rational, just orient life around categories of thinking. And those categories relate to what is real. And everyone has beliefs and assumptions about what is real. What exists? What kind of a universe do I live in? Second, we have beliefs about how we know those things we believe to exist. What is the basis of knowing, and what is the possible extent of what we can know? And everyone has beliefs in these areas as well. Thirdly, there are beliefs or assumptions about what does it mean to be human? Who am I? Do I matter? If I matter, why do I matter? What am I made up of? What is the goop that makes me, me? And fourthly is the area of values, moral values, aesthetic values. What is it that makes something beautiful? What is it that makes something good or bad, right or wrong, just or unjust? And all human beings, and in all cultures, in all religious and philosophical systems, regardless of how simple or complex, all human beings orient their life in these four areas. And they are represented in literature, in art, in religion, in philosophy, in entertainment, in music, in every cultural form we have. They reflect core beliefs, basic beliefs in these areas. And these are the things then, these are the kind of the foundational principles that make up a world's life view or worldview, their lens through which they look out at the world and they look into themselves and they draw conclusions about the direction my life should go. They begin to formulate opinions about what may or may not be a live option for me in terms of entertaining the possibility of a new belief, a new relationship, a change of some sort. And so some of those basic beliefs, some of those worldview assumptions are deeply biblical assumptions because, of course, there is a biblical worldview that relates to fundamental ideas about what is real, how reality can be known, what it means to be me, and the values that lead us and guide us. So why that's important is because these beliefs, these basic ideas, this interpretive grid through which we view our lives and draw these assessments can be either a great catalyst for us to draw deeper understanding and deeper awareness, perhaps even closer connection with God and with others, a life that is increasingly worth living. Or they can, in the language of Paul in 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 to 5, erect barriers against the knowledge of God, fortresses against the knowledge of God, which are ideological in their makeup. And so I want to talk just a minute about how we come to these basic beliefs, and because that's going to be a part of the understanding of how to assess these things carefully and well. The first is to recognize that most people's basic beliefs, their core assumptions, the really important assumptions about life, are not the result of careful study and deliberation. That rather, we come to our basic beliefs more or less having absorbed them through the culture that exists around us, and they come to us more in terms of attitudes than they do by a clear presentation of, hey, this is what's real. This is what it means to be human. This is the nature and extent of human knowledge, and this is what values are. Those things don't come to us analytically like that. They come to us through our interaction with media. They come to us through the car in front of us and the bumper sticker on the back. And they come through us in various ways like that, and we just find ourselves absorbing attitudes. The best way to prove that this is the case is by looking at public opinion surveys. After certain things happen that are highly publicized in the news, for instance, a shooting or something like that, they'll immediately do a public survey about people's beliefs about gun control and violence. What you notice at every point is that the perceived need for thoughtful gun control shoots way up after, you know, children are shot in their elementary school or whatever. But then what happens, you know, a few weeks later? Goes back down again. And so you see how malleable, secondly, people's beliefs are. How subject they are to influences outside themselves, which they're often not even aware are operating on them, but which have a significant amount of influence on this ever-shaping, ever-changing thing that is our worldview. Very importantly, the sources from which most people receive their core beliefs, their worldviews, are not rationally credible sources. Hearsay, playgrounds, various kinds of traditions that aren't thought out, just the attitudes of a family or whatever. Some of those things, of course, are important and must be preserved, but the reality is that people come to their beliefs not having thought them out at all, but rather from completely non-rational and sometimes irrational sources. Even among academics, and this is sort of the thing that is on my mind a lot, having spent a number of years in the academic context, to see colleagues, for instance, who are experts in a particular area, begin to develop classes, for instance, in an area that is not their expertise. And what they are bringing so often into this other area is not well thought out, well researched, content, but is rather something that more or less reflects their own bias or the bias of the academic environment of which they are a part. On Tuesday night, I spent the evening with a philosophy professor in a prominent university in the city of Columbus, the name of which will go unmentioned. And this man is a mathematical logician, and he is a real sharp guy, and he is has a voice in his field, and he told me one of the things that he's particularly excited about now having received tenure is that he wants to teach a course on the relationship between science and religion. And I thought, well, that's awesome. I'm interested in that too. And so we began to talk, and he's like, well, first we begin with the idea that religion is based on myth and science is based on reason. And I'm like, really? And he said, well, of course, I mean, it's axiomatic, right? I'm like, no, I don't think so. It seems to me that the character of the New Testament is a historical narrative falsifiable by the available evidence, and the references to concrete people and places and times and such make it a narrative of objective accounting of events, whereas the Enuma Elish and all these other myths that you refer to are non-historical in character and are explicitly mythological. And he's like, well, I just don't see that. I'm like, well, you may not see that, but at least expose yourself to the literature that parses this out before you teach your class, please. I remember as an undergraduate at the same August institution here in Columbus, Ohio, just north of downtown, I was taking a course called The Bible as Literature. And it was in the English department, because it's, of course, the Bible is literature. And the professor was making confident assertions about the essentially non-historical nature of especially New Testament texts, the Gospels and the Book of Acts, and certainly large tracts of the Old Testament as well. And I happened at the same time to be taking a class that quarter in the history department in which the Book of Acts was one of the textbooks. And so I bring this up to you because we get bombarded by messages about what's true and what's real and what makes you you and the values that drive us. And sometimes we think, well, they're coming from a person in a place of authority or of expertise. But we have to ask the further question, are they speaking in that area of expertise? Are they speaking off the cuff in a way that is shaded completely by their own perceptions and their beliefs, their prejudices and their attitudes that have nothing to do with the intellectual content about which they are speaking? You see what I mean? And so we live in this real confused place where it's hard to find sometimes a real base of confidence, a core of what we can really appeal to think things through. And we add to this the idea, not only do people's beliefs usually arise out of ill-thought means, sources and so forth, but also that they are often oblivious to the very things that they do believe. And so one of the exercises that I used to make my students endure in the first day of their philosophy class, if they were unfortunate enough to get me as instructor, would be to ask them this very simple question. Why are you in my class? And they would look at me like, why am I in your class? And so someone would put in their hand and say, well, I need a humanities requirement. That's why I'm here. I'm like, thanks, that's honest. I'm glad you're not BSing me with the idea that you're here for the pure intellectual stimulation and to be a better person and whatever. You need a humanities credit. That's great. And why do you need a humanities credit? Well, I need the credit to get a degree. That's awesome. And you need to get a degree. Why? Well, to get a job, of course. Well, that's cool. Why work? What's the point? See, philosophers are very infantile. We always ask why? Well, because you have to work to get money. I'm like, okay, great. Why do you need money? Well, they're as exasperated as you are trying to listen to this. Because it takes money to buy things, you see. I'm like, sweet. Well, why do you need to buy things? Well, they say, to be happy, of course. And I'd say, well, why do you need to be happy? And there's the conversation ends. I'm like, okay, what have we done? We've arrived at a basic belief where the answer, the question why, no longer has an answer. We're at the end of the road. And what does it mean? I'm here because ultimately I want to be happy. And how am I going to be happy? It's through the acquisition of things, through a job that's going to get me money, and this college degree is going to help me get to that place. You see what I'm saying? Boom. You're here because you want to be happy and you think money's going to make you happy. Now, there's probably all kinds of other reasons, but that's the reason that you're presenting. And let's then begin to analyze that belief. And what kind of a world is it that says that happiness comes through the acquisition of things? And what kind of person are you that would derive a sense of happiness in that way? And that's sort of what it means to begin to rationally engage the world of ideas. But the point I'm trying to make is that one of the things that we want to be able to do is interact with our world in such a way that we begin to help people come to terms with the reality of the fact that they do work out of a set of assumptions, often of which they are unaware, usually of which they have no rational foundation. And a big part of our witness to this world is to help people walk in the light of reason, to expose their thinking in the light of the canons of reason and ultimately of revelation itself, because that's how we're going to move people in a place where a positive apologetic, reasons that come out of the scripture for the existence of God, the truth of the Christian truth claims especially, begin to make sense. Because if we don't do this work sometimes on the front end, we'll be feeding information to a grid that is unable to accept it, is unable to understand it. It's like the Bible is in Apple format, and the person we're talking to is in the IBM format, and I guess they fixed that problem, but it used to be that was a good analogy because they were not able to work together. So it's an important part of our communication that we learn how to interact in a worldview-ish sort of way. And then secondly, that we learn how to critically examine the content of people's basic beliefs. And that's really what we want to talk about right here. And what we want to describe is the fact that there are various kinds of worldviews, which we'll define in just a minute, and we want to assess them according to a principle of hypothetical reasoning. Hypothetical reasoning is just a technique, a four-part technique that is used in the natural sciences, in the social sciences, and in forensic science, and all kinds of places, really to get at the truth of the matter. And it's rooted in four things. So we're going to think about a worldview, a set of beliefs, as an hypothesis. And that hypothesis is going to be examined then in the light of whether it's coherent, consistent, adequate, or fruitful. By which I mean a coherent hypothesis is one that's rationally, internally consistent, that what a person believes, their understanding of reality, knowledge, what it means to be human, and their values is consistent with itself, that there's nothing in that hypothesis that affirms or implies something that's self-contradictory. If you hold a view that is inherently self-contradictory, that view is by definition false. If your whole life is rooted in the thought that 2 plus 2 equals 87, problematic, because that's just not true. And so some examples would be, like, for instance, there are many who believe that human choices are biologically determined. They think, well, human beings are basically a sophisticated machine that are governed by the principles, the rules of biological or neurobiological or neurochemical interactions. These things are utterly definable and describable in terms of natural law, principles of chemical interaction, and that is what 100% of human thought and behavior is rooted in. They believe that, and on the other side of it, they will say, but yet a person is responsible for their choices. Now, what's wrong with that? How can you be responsible for what you do if what you do is being is the product of things that are beyond your own ability to control, because you are essentially a biological puppet? So that would be an example of a hypothesis, or a part of a hypothesis, that contains two ideas that can't both be true. And since they both can't be true, we're going to have to either revise the hypothesis in some way, or we're going to have to can it altogether. And so that would be, again, that's what we mean by coherence. By consistency, what we mean about a hypothesis is that it is consistent with the body of well-established knowledge that have been established through many lines of evidence. And it's just basically the idea that there are all kinds of maybe coherent hypotheses that aren't rationally impossible, but which are so far out there that they just they bear no relationship to other things that we know to be true about the world in which we live. And so, for instance, it was a big deal back in the day. I don't know if it still is or not. You know, the Painted Desert out there in Arizona has this really large, huge, acres-long designs in the sand. And it was thought, well, the reason why that's there is because those are alien landing sites, and which is possible. Is there anything inherently impossible about the idea that there are aliens that might use planet Earth occasionally as a pit stop or something like that? Possible? Yeah. But why would you believe it? Because is there anything other than your take on the Painted Desert that might lead you to the thought that there are aliens out there? We've been looking for aliens in an intentional way for decades now. There's no evidence that they're out there. And so this would be a very poor hypothesis, because even though it's possible, it just bears no relationship whatsoever to the world that we live in. Adequacy is the third criteria, and adequacy is the ability of an hypothesis to explain all of the relevant facts. All of the relevant facts. And so we always prefer an hypothesis that explains all or almost all of the information it's designed to explain, as opposed to an hypothesis that explains only a limited number of things that it is intended to explain. So, for example, we use this language, heliocentrism. Okay, here's a hypothesis. Geocentrism. This is the old view that the Earth was at the center of the universe, and that all things revolved in a perfect sphere, a circle around planet Earth. And there's a whole theology, in fact, in the Middle Ages that was constructed out of this belief in geocentrism. And it worked great for sailors in the Mediterranean at night. They were able to establish star charts with this assumption and be guided by night in that way. But once people began going outside of the Mediterranean and out into the Atlantic and down the African coast, they began to realize that these star charts were no longer able to predict where they were. And this forced them to consider a new hypothesis that was coming out of this weird dude in Italy by the name of Galileo, who said, no, what's in fact the case is that it's not the Earth, but it's the sun that is at the center, and the Earth revolves around it. And that enabled the star charts to be changed and become more accurate. And then other astronomers came along and confirmed this with the thought that if we assume that the sun, not the Earth, is at the center of the solar system, or the center of the, our galaxy, or whatever it is, I guess they would call it, they wouldn't call it solar system, would they? They would call it the Earth system. Anyway, if the sun is really at the center, not the Earth, then that would also explain the elliptical orbits of planets that were now being discovered by an increasingly growing population of astronomers. And so for that reason, because they explain more and more of the available information, the whole heliocentric idea came into being. The whole idea that the Earth is at the center was was discarded, and this is the idea that came in. Why? Because it explained all of the observable data that is relevant to it. And then lastly, there's this idea of fruitfulness. Fruitfulness is whether or not the hypothesis can be used in a fruitful way or in a livable way or in a productive way into the future. Can it be put into practice in a way that actually makes sense? And so one of the great applications of physics, for instance, is the ability to make products and technology, assuming the theoretical science that actually functions in the real world. That's livability, and in some cases it's predictability. And so, for instance, the predictable element of a fruitful hypothesis would be part of the evolutionary model that says that changes in species occur through adaptation to the environment and genetic mutation. Not only can that be tested, but it can also be used to predict future biological life, and people use that all the time in plant biology and in other areas, and it works very, very well, given the assumptions about how mutation might work and environment might work in a plant species. We can predict very well that this kind of hybrid that we're promoting will be a much better kind of product to use in this very poor soil. Or something like that. So agronomy and agriculture come together in an important way in developing countries like Haiti and other places that desperately need that kind of technology. And so here is our framework. You see what I'm saying? All ideas, all sets of ideas that are worldviews can be impartially, objectively, and rationally assessed in the light of these four categories. And our job then as Christian communicators and apologists will be able to look at the Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, and defend its coherence, consistency, adequacy, and fruitfulness, while at the same time engaging with non-biblical worldviews, exposing the incoherence, inconsistency, inadequacy, and unfruitfulness of those basic beliefs. Make sense? At least in principle, are you with me? Just nod. All right. I know it's after lunch, it's before dinner, our blood sugar is low, it's challenging. Okay, let's now turn to the question of, if we have looked through this test, we've applied coherence, consistency, adequacy, and fruitfulness to our worldviews, what do we say? We say that hypotheses are confirmed or disconfirmed. They're not, in ultimate sense, proven or disproven. No theory, no hypothesis is ever absolutely certain. Well, it can be absolutely certainly wrong. We know that, if it's incoherent. But even when we say that, you know, yeah, it's coherent for sure, and it is pretty consistent, pretty adequate, and pretty fruitful, at least more so, for instance, than its rivals, alternative hypotheses, then we say of that hypothesis that it has been confirmed. Or if it comes out on the negative side of the assessment, that it's been disconfirmed. Really a well-grounded, well-assessed hypothesis that has been viewed through various lenses in various ways over a period of time, and it just stands up to this hypothetical examination, is called then an established theory. Gravity is a well-established theory. It applies to so many different areas. It has predictive value. It is mathematically coherent. It is consistent with everything that we know about the world. And it is adequate to explain everything that quantum physics doesn't, or that relativity theory needs to step in and supplement. How those worlds come together is complicated, but it would be considered a well-established theory. So here's what we want to do then. We want to take this basic framework of reasoning, and we want to apply it to worldviews. We want to say a worldview is an hypothesis, and what I've done, this is kind of notation, and I want to make it really clear on the front end of this, that there are four basic kind of conceptual frameworks that people operate within worldwide and throughout history, actually. And they would be materialism, the idea that the only thing that exists is matter and energy. Pantheism, the idea, this comes out of Asian thinking and rooted ultimately in Hinduism, but it has its application to Buddhism, which came out of Hinduism, and other Asian forms of religion that center on the idea of pan, everything. Theism is God, all things are God. Postmodernism, that's kind of a contemporary view I want to talk about, and then of course biblical theism. I want to make it really clear to you that there are very few people who are consistent across the board. You may be a materialist in relation to your views of reality, but you may be a theist in relation to your view of values. In fact, that's pretty common in our culture, and we need to examine that idea. But anyway, people have sort of a cafeteria approach to their beliefs in our culture, which actually I think is super helpful, because having this great cafeteria of fundamentally contradictory ideas in their belief system, it provides great opportunity to engage and say, well, you've said this over here, and you said the other thing over there. Those things don't match up very well in the world that we know about. So what is it? You know, and to be able to help people come to a place where they're beginning to think consciously about what they've accepted subconsciously, where they're beginning to assess and analyze what they've more or less absorbed uncritically. And this brings people to a place where I think that there is real room for common ground and conversation about spiritual things. Because at the end of the day, once we think about it, regardless of what we believe, we live in God's world. There is only one reality. And that being so, as we think about that one reality, it provides for us a way to come together so that the person who is not a Christian with whom we're interacting is not our adversary, not our sparring partner, but is a fellow traveler down the road of life seeking to discover what's really true. And we're helping them along the way, and we're interacting along the way, and that's how it should work. That's the nature of that relationship. Let's talk about this then very briefly. A materialist says that all that exists is matter in a closed system of cause and effect. That's materialism. Just matter exists, molecules, atoms, there's energy involved. Matter and energy are more or less flip sides of the same coin, and that's all there is. There's no God, there's no soul, there's nothing immaterial that exists. How do we know reality? The word we're using here is scientism, but basically what we're saying here is that the authority of the senses is absolute in the area of knowledge. The only thing that you can know are things that you can measure, or at least potentially measure, in a laboratory. Things that are, or through your senses at least, things that you see. The old expression, seeing is believing, would fit kind of in a fundamental way, a formal way in this idea. And so other ways of knowing, through intuition, through revelation, things like that would be necessarily out for the materialist. What does it mean to be a person? Well, a person, of course, because they are part of a material nexus that is reality, are complex moral organisms. And to put predicates or descriptions to human beings about free will, for instance, would be incompatible with the idea that we're a part of this closed system of cause and effect, this idea that we're all things operate according to the unchanging laws of nature. So that's what we are. We are different in complexity, but not different in kind from all other life forms in the world. And then lastly, in terms of values, it's difficult to see where values necessarily come in this framework. Some of the great humanists of the early Greek philosophical tradition, like Protagoras, was the one who said man is the measure of all things. Since there's nothing greater than humanity, humanity is at the apex of the complexity heap, Whatever it is that we think is good is good. Whatever we think is just, and so forth. Well, we'll examine that in just a little bit, but that's the basic framework for materialism. I want to say a little bit less, or a lot less, about pantheism because we just don't encounter it that much. But it's the idea that reality is impersonal, eternal spirit. The only thing that exists, it's like materialism says, the only thing that exists is matter. What the pantheist says, that the only thing that exists is spirit. And by spirit, they mean something more akin to what we might call electricity or something like that. Just kind of an energy that is not personal. That's not good or bad, right or wrong. It doesn't think or anything like that. Just, well, the word they use, om. What exists? Om. That's what exists. And so how do we know? Well, we don't know by rationality. It's really not a part of the discussion. Reason doesn't relate to reality because what we call the reality that we sense with our five senses is illusion, or maya, as it's called in the Sanskrit. And so just as the materialists would say that the perception of a mind or a soul or the perception of God or something like that is just an illusion. And so Sigmund Freud wrote his famous treatise on religion called The Future of an Illusion. The pantheist, on the flip end of that, says the perception of the material world is actually illusion. What does it mean to be a person in pantheism? Well, it means that there is no person in the sense that we would think about that. There is no me, there is no you, there's only om. That's what exists. And you and I are one with that. Whatever that is what you are. So in a kind of way of describing that in Hindu writing is you have this cup of water and have a sip. Nice water. Pour in a spoon of salt. Shake it up. And everywhere in the cup that you drink the water, it tastes salty. And it's like, okay, that's what we're talking about here. You, that grain of salt, are one with that cup of water. There's no difference at all in kind. There is no you. And in terms of values, everything that you perceive to happen in the world around you, the world of illusion, is governed by karma, the principle of cause and effect. Why do things happen to individuals that happen to them? Because the universe is operating on this principle of cause and effect, of karma, that makes good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. I realize that's confusing. We're going to leave it right there. Postmodern, the popular version of the way people think today, where reality is not something that we can characterize or define. We don't, people who are postmodern don't say, well, yeah, it's all materialism. That's all that exists. It's just matter on matter in a closed system of cause and effect, rules of material interaction or whatever. And it's not God or anything like that. Reality is actually an idea that comes out of our social interaction with one another, and it's going to be different for one society than for another. And so for some societies, an animistic society, everything's God. And that's their reality. American industrial technological society, everything is matter, and that's our reality. And reality is basically a product of social thinking, and that's whatever the consensus of the culture is, that's really what reality is, because we don't have any kind of objective place to understand reality. There's a skepticism in our day in the postmodern frame. And the idea here is that no one has a kind of a God's eye view of what's true. And so we just have to make up stories within the limited framework of our own experience, defined in terms of language. All of our thinking in this view is rooted in language. As you're thinking to yourself right now, you are using words. You're saying to yourself, this is abstract. I'm hungry. I wonder what the person on my left is thinking right now. And so on and so forth. You're thinking, your inner world is guided and shaped by language. But think about, what is the meaning of a word? How do you know what a word means? How about look it up in a dictionary? And then so you get a definition of what does the word mean, but what does the definition mean? Where do you go? To the same dictionary. And you look up what all the words mean that make up that definition. And then you just see where this thing is going, that all meaning, all language is kind of this self, is a circle. Is always defined in terms of itself. It's self-referential. It doesn't relate to anything outside of language. And as a result, knowledge is only an expression of a particular language. That the rules of grammar and the rules of syntax and semantics really shape and mold all of our thinking and become the foundation of all of our interactions. And since languages differ from culture to culture, from place to place, of course we're going to conceptualize reality in different ways. That's a relativistic view. And people, as we think about ourselves, are also the product of language. We too are social constructions, as are values. What does it mean to be good or bad, right or wrong, or whatever? Well, there's nothing to which our language of good and bad, right or wrong, just or unjust refer. So therefore, what? They refer to my preferences or my desire for empowerment or whatever. And that really is where we are as a culture today. There's no common ground. There's no rational way to talk about what's true or good or just or unjust. It's a matter of posturing and the appeal to power at various levels. And that's how we resolve our differences. And biblical theism stands in this context as saying, no, reality is not as the pantheist says. It's not all spirit. But there's a part of it that's true, that there is a spiritual dimension. The materialist is wrong in saying that only things that exist are material things. But it is true, as they say, that matter does exist. And at the apex of what it means to be real is an infinite and personal God. That's reality from the biblical point of view. And how do we know? Two things. Reason. Because God has constructed the world in a certain way and has constructed us as knowers in his image to engage the world that he made in a certain way. This is what we were getting at last Wednesday night. It's possible for us to have true beliefs, true understanding about the way things actually are. And there is this idea of revelation that God communicates both in the natural order and through his word, the scriptures, and ultimately through his son. So we can know ultimate reality in that way. What are people? People are in the image of God. We are spiritual and physical. And in terms of values, there is a design that God gave all of us as human beings in his image. That's the basis of what's good and just and right. And these things are objective in nature. We don't make them up, but they are expressions of the infinite and personal God. So that, in a very general sense, are categories of how everyone engages life, how everyone engages the world. And it will be possible, if we're just able to interact and think as we're talking with people, that as I'm listening to them talk and as we're having conversation, that I'm picking up signals that what they're really suggesting is that, you know, maybe that materialism is true, that all you can really know is what experimental or physical sciences tell us is the case. And so we're kind of at a dead end with them to talk about the God question, because, but for them, it's like, how, we can't even talk about God because that goes beyond the limits of what can be known. See what I'm saying? That's a worldview assumption, and we're going to have to be able to engage that assumption. And so, let's begin to do that. Let's think about, as we interact, We're asking questions perhaps to clarify. What do you mean when you say it's impossible to know God? You say you're an agnostic. What does that mean? Does it mean that you personally don't know God? Well, there's some information I would like to share with you that might provide a basis for you to know God. Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm not just saying I don't know God. I'm saying God cannot be known. Why? Well, because the only things that can be known are the things that can be known through the scientific method, things like that. And since God as a spirit is not reducible to measuring and testing in that way, God, therefore, by definition, cannot be known. Oh, I see. I got it. You're a materialist and a radical empiricist. Okay, I didn't know that, but yes, you are. So let's think about then, how do we want to interact with these things? Let's talk about the materialist. Is the materialist hypothesis coherent? Is reducing everything to empirical measurement possible? Does that even make sense as a principle? Let's think about that. The materialist is committed to this principle. The only sentences whose subject is a physically measurable object can be true. That's the assumption that the materialist makes. Now, let me ask you this. Is that a coherent statement? Think about it. What's going on with this statement? It's saying only sentences, this is a sentence, only sentences whose subject is a physically measurable object can be true. Okay? But what is it? What is the physically measurable object in that sentence? There isn't one. There isn't one. The whole idea that when they say, here's the deal. The principle is only physical things can be known. The principle is not a physical thing that can be known. And is therefore rationally self-defeating. It can't possibly be true. Because if it's true, the proposition's false. But if the proposition's false, then it doesn't matter. And the basic idea of the radical empiricist assumption that only material things can be known is itself rooted in a principle that is itself not empirical. Let's think about it in another way. The materialist who believes, for instance, most people think killing innocent people is wrong. Boy, that is a fact. That's a measurable fact. We all know that's a fact, right? Therefore, they draw the conclusion, murder is wrong. Now, what's wrong with the inference from 1 to 2? Okay, well, not all people think that it's wrong. That's true. And so there's sort of this majority vote view of morality. But what else? Not all people are interested. Yeah. Innocent, okay, that's true too. So their death might not be murder in that sense. Good. What makes a majority view true? That's an interesting question as well. Huh? Thinking's not material. That's an important point. So that kind of raises this question of how do we trust this view if it's rooted in something that can't be trusted? Good. What else? What do you mean by it begs the question? Okay, what kind of premise is number one? It is a premise about facts, right? It's a factual statement that most people believe murder is wrong. You see that? But what kind of a statement is number two? Well, it's hard, yeah, but Number two is a value statement, isn't it? It's about rightness and wrongness, not about what is or what isn't. It's a fundamentally different kind of statement altogether. The materialists, every single time they argue from facts about what people desire, facts about what might be more pleasurable for the most number of people, or facts about whatever human psychology and our preferences, to a conclusion about the way things should be done, the way things ought to be, the way that people should be treated, are making a leap from a factual statement to a value statement. And the fundamental principle of logic is this, my friends. There is nothing in the conclusion that isn't already implicit in the premises. If the premises are a factual statement, the conclusion must also be factual. If the premises are value statements, then the conclusion must be value statements. But to confuse categories is illogical. If I said, all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, what would I conclude? Socrates is mortal. Fact, fact, conclusion, fact, right? If I say all men are mortal and Socrates is mortal, and I conclude, therefore, Socrates is a person of great dignity, it doesn't follow because why? Because that's a value statement about Socrates that doesn't factor into the discussion. Every time a person from an atheistic point of view, a materialistic point of view, argues for morality and says that there really are things like right and wrong, just or unjust, they commit what one philosopher called G.E. Moore has called the naturalistic fallacy, that you argue to a values conclusion based upon factual assumptions. Just because people desire certain things doesn't mean that their desires are good or right, do they? Of course not. And so in all cases, when we deal with a person who says, well, I'm basically an atheist or whatever, I just think whatever exists is material or whatever, but I sure think that we ought not to treat people like this. You can stop and say, wait a minute, where did you go from the only thing that exists is material things and facts about the material world are the only things that we can know to value statements about how people should or ought to be treated? Every time you make that move, you commit a fallacy of reasoning. And to that extent, your worldview is fundamentally incoherent. See what I'm saying? Okay. I use this as an example because that is invariably the kind of discussion that you will find yourself getting into with a non-theist and with a materialist in particular. In terms of consistency, there are problems with the materialistic assumptions. If you've been listening to Dr. Lennox or Dr. Craig or some of these other sessions we've been having, that there are real problems with issues of origins that relate to our understanding of biological life on the earth, or the design that seems to be there, where there are no known mechanisms to explaining life from non-life. And to that extent, materialism is not a very assumption that's consistent with the world that we know, because materialism doesn't allow us to explain how organic life emerges out of a soup of non-biological chemicals. And similarly, and with the design problem, how does information-bearing systems emerge out of just a random collection of inorganic atoms and molecules? And there's no way to match that with the real world that we live in, and to that extent, it's a problematic theory. It may be held onto because they don't want to go the other direction, the God direction, and okay, that's a different matter. But there are problems with the theory, because it cannot explain the world as we know it and as we see it. In terms of adequacy, materialism, and we want to think along these lines, is an insufficient explanation for human personhood. So a materialist would say, all you are is a sophisticated bag of chemicals. And for that reason, there's no such thing as free will. And that opens up some problems, because it just says you're a complex, you know, like a machine, a robot, or something like that. And that is going to, in turn, create problems in terms of responsibility, even our ability to reason. If we accept the materialistic hypothesis, we must deny the intrinsic moral value of all human beings. This was Bill Craig's argument yesterday morning. He spent an hour on really this very question right here. If we start with material assumptions, how do we assign value to a human being? Why do we say that one biological organism is more important than another, or has rights that another doesn't have? And so there's a problem in this area. And lastly, of course, for the materialists, the fruitfulness in the area of values becomes a real issue. Which man is the measure of all things? And there is no basis to resist evils like social Darwinism, the assumption driving the Nazi extermination camps. How can we say that's wrong if we live in this Darwinian world that operates on the basis of survival of the fittest, of adaptation? And we can't morally resist that point of view. As the old Greek debater Thrasymachus put it, justice is the interest of the stronger. There are no rights for the weak, the marginalized, or whatever. And so if a person we're interacting with has lofty notions of belief that there are such things as human rights or objective moral goods, things like that, they cannot be operating from a materialistic point of view. Are you following me? I'm just kind of powering right through. We'll have some time for interaction in just a couple of minutes here. In pantheism, I want to just cover this very briefly. The idea that there all exists as an eternal, impersonal spirit is impossible to defend because it defies the idea that there are reasons or rationality. Distinctions about true or false, like all distinctions, are just illusions. And so statements like this, like everything that exists is eternal, impersonal spirit, cannot be either true or false. It's just because it defies that possibility to make the distinction. It's inconsistent because it must reject all human experience that we actually live in a physical world. It's possible that everything's an illusion. It's also possible that the world was created 5 minutes ago. It's possible, but it just is not consistent with anything that we know and experience in the world around us. Is it an adequate theory? It has to explain all awareness of the self as just purely an illusion. And that's a pretty hard thing to do, because if you're the one who is arguing the case that you're an illusion, there is an I doing that arguing. You see what I'm saying? It's a little ironic. A little ironic. Never mind. Okay. There's no basis to resist evil or injustice if all we are is an illusion. And if bad things are happening to you because of the laws of karma, actually, we could argue, and maybe should argue, that there's no, we should, it would be a problem to resist evil and to end suffering, because the people who are suffering deserve it because of the karmic debt that they have built up over a past life or whatever. You gotta let them burn it off. And that has absolutely social implications for places like India. The postmodern view of language, that it's all this big circle, it's always just defined in terms of other words and stuff, is completely rationally incoherent. Because look at this sentence. All language is circular and relates only to itself, not an objective world, is an objectively true statement about language. You see the problem with that? That's self-contradictory. That's what that is. It's assuming something that it denies. And therefore, must be rejected as the obvious fallacy that it is. Language is not just circular if it's saying something that's actually true. And everyone who espouses these postmodern ideas that everything is a social construct and language doesn't lead to anything or whatever is using language to express those ideas and believes that they're actually communicating. But that is a self-contradiction. The postmodernist denies all absolutes as intolerant or absolutist, but let's think about that. It is totally wrong to impose your beliefs on others. See a problem with that? What is that? That's a belief imposed on others, namely all others. That's a self-contradiction. It's inconsistent. The postmodernist can't explain free will. The postmodernist has no moral grounds to resolve differences. If all our beliefs and ideas are just manipulations of language, there is no truth about the issue of how people ought to be treated. There is no real right or wrong, and justice is just a power play. Since no one can appeal to objective moral truths, power is all that we're left with when we disagree. What a horrible world is envisioned by the postmodernist. So with these kind of analytical thoughts in mind, we turn finally and briefly to biblical theism. The idea here is that the biblical view of God is a coherent view. And even in light of the objections, and these are the three that will always come up. The person that you're interacting with, if they've thought about it much, are going to say, well, you know, your thing about God is incoherent because, well, what about evil? Your thing about God is incoherent because how can God know the future and still and be certain about that and still have a place for free will? And what's up with this Trinity thing? Is God one? Is God three? What is it? And so it's important, I think, for us as Christians to be able to have responses to things like this. The problem of evil. God is all-powerful and could prevent suffering. We believe that that's true. God is all-loving and would not want people to suffer. That seems to be the case. People suffer. That's definitely true. So therefore, it must mean then that God is either not all-loving or not all-powerful. And I just want to suggest to you that that is a powerful argument. And how do you interact with that to show that there's something wrong with that argument that doesn't then lead to the incoherence of the God you say exists? See, and it's important that Christians be able to engage in that question. Norman Geisler has written an important book called The Roots of Evil. It's a real short and accessible book. I think it can be gotten online. And it's a very simple analysis of that argument right there and provides, I think, intuitive and easy to express responses to what's wrong with the principle premise, which is number one, God is all powerful and can prevent suffering. Why? What's wrong with that premise right there? Let's think about that. What's wrong with that premise? If God is all powerful, he can prevent suffering. What if the suffering that we're talking about is the product of free choice of creatures? Then God, though he is all-powerful, if we have freedom, would not be able to prevent us from the exercise of that freedom and its consequence in the real world, the so-called free will defense. I think that makes sense, and I'm just summarizing it briefly here. I'll get to you in a second. But we need to be able to look at these arguments from the critic's point of view and also have intelligent, responsible comebacks to that, just as we would expect from them. The biblical world view of theism fits the world that we experience, that the world is finite. And it had a beginning that begs the question of how it came into being. That is complex and information-bearing, which indicates design. That is populated with people like you and me that seem to have intrinsic value. And so in terms of adequacy, the ability of theism to explain the uniqueness and the corruption of man is very important. And cannot be defined in terms outside of biblical theism. What is the basis for human dignity? Biblical theism is the highest form of humanism. Not that man is the measure of all things, but that man is qualitatively different than all things that God has created in this universe. And in that sense, is the crown of creation. But corrupt because we're outside of God's will and purpose for us. And in biblical theism, there is a foundation in an infinite personal God who is himself good for social justice and for moral norms that cannot be extracted out of a postmodern, socially constructed reality, out of a pantheistic, impersonal universe, out of a materialistic world that is operating on the principles of mutation and adaptation. It is only in the framework of a biblical view that we can talk meaningfully and objectively in the realm of values. So, okay, that is covering a lot of material. And that's why you have the handout. Because the goal here is for us as Christian communicators to have a kind of a running understanding of how to recognize these facets of a worldview, of understanding what the principles of assessing a worldview are, and some kind of concrete examples in our own minds as we're interacting with someone about what's wrong with what they are saying or implying that arises out of their worldview, not for the purpose of winning an argument, but for creating an openness to information about God that might lead them to a relationship with him through Jesus Christ. So that's the purpose. So I'll turn the fire hose off and the microphone's on, and we've got a few minutes to interact with questions or comments you'd like to make. Over here.
When you were discussing the coherence of biblical theism, the point that you made about if God is all-powerful and God could prevent suffering, why didn't he? Uh-huh. And then you said, well, if free will is introduced, then we have the problem that maybe we chose for the suffering to happen.
That God could be all-powerful, but even an all-powerful God,
might
if
allow
he's truly granted freedom, that freedom has to manifest itself in the real world.
Sure.
Yes.
For me, that just presents a new question, which is, why can't an all-powerful God somehow allow for free will while also allowing for no suffering?
I didn't hear the last part of what you said.
Why can't a God who's all-powerful allow for free will whilst also not allowing suffering?
Well, he couldn't prevent the suffering if he's granting true freedom to his creatures, is the point.
Well, then for me, that's a contradiction, because now you've made God not all-powerful.
What we're saying is that God, there are certain things God cannot do as illogical. God cannot make a bachelor a married man, right?
I guess that's the question. I mean...
That's my point, see. That's the point. There are limits on even on God's omnipotence that God can't make 2 plus 2 equal 88. God can't make a bachelor to be a married man. Because by definition, those things don't add up. And so what we're saying is that by definition, if God has granted to creatures actual freedom to affect the external world through their choices, that God limits his omnipotence by definition to accommodate that possibility. And the theological tradition, except for the most extreme forms of determinism, accept that that's basically the case. I don't think that that's heretical or even controversial. I think almost every theological system accepts that that's true.
I think that's a fair answer.
Well, we can talk afterwards.
No, I think that's a fair answer.
Okay. I thought you said that's a variance. Okay. Thank you. I'm glad you think it's fair. In the way back.
You mentioned helping people see some of the contradictions and that there is possibly one reality, God, and helping them to see that. Mm-hmm. What would you say to someone who sees the contradictions and says, oh, that's nice, we all believe different things, more or less like in the lecture last night, the lady at the restaurant? So what suggestion would you have? Because I've been in situations where people see these contradictions and usually go to the elephant analogy or something, the different parts of the elephant, the same person feeling it. So do you have suggestions on that?
Well, I think just the simple response is that When people are making claims about the way things actually are, they're not making claims about their perceptions or about their private beliefs. They're making assertions about the objective nature of reality. If I say that there is this thing called gravity, it's not just, you know, for me there's gravity. I'm saying that there exists an objective world such that in all places and in all times, this law governs at least some of what's going on there. So you could relativize it and say, well, it's just true for you or whatever, but what I would respond to, I'd say, but you're not listening to me because that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that my belief is what is the way things are for everyone. And not just for me. And the believers in religious traditions around the world, we were in Japan some years ago doing some work, and there was a conference that had occurred just months before by a very famous philosopher of religion who uses this elephant thing, and he's basically saying, you know, the Japanese should embrace their Zen Buddhism, and the Hindus should embrace their Hinduism, and Christians in the West should embrace that, because it's all a part of the same thing. We just have our own little limited vantage point, and the real problem, the real tragedy is when we try to extrapolate from our experience to say this is the way things really are. It was very interesting that the Buddhists were the ones who pushed back the hardest. And they said, that's not what we're saying. We're not saying we're creating our own reality. We're saying we're describing the way everyone's reality actually is. And so ironically, this attempt at being tolerant and inclusive ends up offending all people who hold serious beliefs. And we don't understand that, I think, in our culture. But it is profoundly offensive. And a gross misrepresentation of what other people believe, to simplify it to that simple kind of elephant illustration. It's just not what people mean when they say that they hold beliefs. And if you're saying, well, but that is the way it actually is, then we would say, well, what part of the elephant are you holding? See what I'm saying? Because you're not making, if you're pretending to make an objective statement about the nature of all belief, then you're privy to something that nobody else is. Right? It's pretty arrogant. Got a couple of minutes and a couple of hands. And no microphone. Oh, you, I'm sorry. I'm blinded by the light.
Okay, so my question is, what can we say to people that only believe in just some part of the Bible and others not? Like,
okay.
They're trying to satisfy themselves only believing what they want.
Okay, so some people believe certain parts of the Bible and not others. Like, for instance, it used to be the case, and really still is in a lot of ways, that people would accept as historical parts of the Bible that we could confirm through history, or which seem to be consistent with the world that we experience and can be measured by science. But those parts of the Bible that can't be, like, for instance, the miracles of Jesus, things like that, they'd say, well, that's not real, that's not true, because when's the last time you saw a miracle? Or the demon possession stories in the Gospels or in Acts or in places like that, that's not really true because there's no such thing as demons. Then really they're making an assumption. They're making two assumptions that are key. The one is that they're making assumptions about the way the world is. And they're saying that miracles cannot happen. Really? And how do we know this? And let's have a conversation about what is it about the material world that you know that makes the possibility of God suspending the laws of nature to accomplish a purpose impossible. So that, which is not easy to do, but we need to be able to identify what is underneath the observation and expose the principle that's really at stake, and say, what is your reason for proving that miracles are not possible? Well, I've never seen one. Okay, true, but there are things that maybe we've never seen before. That doesn't mean that they're not possible or they're not real. What about the canons of historiography? The tools like this that historians also use to get at, is this testimony of this historical source, is it plausible? And they use exactly these same techniques to get at stories in the Bible, like the resurrection of Christ from the dead. Bill Craig, who was here Wednesday night and Thursday morning, has written several books on this, and his book, Reasonable Faith, has a lengthy chapter on the possibility of miracles, and followed by a discussion of what is the historical argument for this miraculous event called the resurrection of Christ from the dead. So what we would be saying is that the person who says, I'll take this part of the Bible but not the other part, is really just taking what fits into their worldview, but is not a consistent assessment or a consistent account of the data that's actually there. And so we would want to put that on them and have that conversation. Are you with me on that? Make sense? Okay, and we got no time. It's 5 o'clock. But I'll hang around for a few minutes if you guys are interested in carrying on the conversation. Thanks so much, though, for hanging in at this late hour, and we'll call it a day. Thanks.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.